his bird note. Cuba is home to a unique population of northern bobwhites, with plumage patterns and short bills that set them apart from bobwhites on mainland North America. But where these quail came from has been a mystery. Did humans introduce them from the mainland? If so, when, and why do they look so different? The first written record of bobwhites in Cuba is from 1839. One historical account claims that a Spaniard introduced bobwhites near Havana in the late 1700s, but that doesn't explain how they took on distinct traits so quickly. Confusingly, the same account also says bobwhites were already living elsewhere in Cuba. But recent scientific detective work may have uncovered the answer. By analyzing DNA from museum specimens, researchers show that Cuban bobwhites are hybrids, descended from two different mainland populations that arrived at two different times. It seems that bobwhites from Mexico came to Cuba sometime between the 12th and 16th centuries, possibly introduced by the island's original indigenous peoples. Then, Spanish colonists brought birds from what's now the southeast U.S. less than 300 years ago. These new arrivals interbred with the already established birds, creating today's distinctive population. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Hey guys,
you're listening to Oh My God, Layla's on Fire.
Today we're going to be walking around the SFU campus and we're going to ask people what their thoughts are on Taylor Swift. We're looking to find some hardcore Swifties. Hopefully we do. Keep listening to find out.
Matthew. I enjoyed her music a while ago, but I haven't listened to the new album yet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have strong thoughts one way or the other, really.
It's Natasha. I think she's a great artist. She's very respectable. And her music's actually pretty catchy.
It's Bobby. Listen to her music, so I don't know much about her. Yeah.
Okay.
Jack, I think she's a great artist. I think her album was really good. I think she's a great person in general, but Kanye's better.
My name is Malcolm.
I'm Braxton.
Thank you. And what are your thoughts on Taylor Swift?
Is this for the Taylor Swift Club?
No.
Because I technically joined that in the beginning of the semester, which I think is sick. I think Taylor Swift is cool. I was shamefully obsessed with her when I was younger.
I don't know if that's shameful.
I had shame. No, I think I should have, but I was so young and naive back then.
I didn't listen to a lot of Taylor Swift music, but I remember her album Red, my cousin was obsessed with, and I spent a lot of time with her, and we'd listen to that probably nonstop. At least I think that's Taylor Swift. Is that one of her albums?
Yeah.
It was
like
one of her country albums. So I have a soft spot for Taylor Swift from that. Just reminds me of my cousin. And I think she's killing it and should continue doing it. She deserves everything she has.
Thank you.
She's worked for it.
Well,
I also saw Taylor Swift when I was younger.
That's
live
nice.
In Vancouver in like 20, I don't know, 12 or something. It's pretty fun.
Yeah.
Grace. Taylor Swift. Like her songs or her as an individual? I don't honestly know that much about her. I don't really listen to her that much now, but I guess her like old songs are good. Her older songs are throwbacks. Yeah.
Harshita. Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
I love her. Like.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm really, really big fan of her, and I would love to go to her concert.
Do you have a favorite song?
Yeah, what's your favorite song?
I don't remember the name of the song, but like this song is like in my mind nowadays. It's like, this is where the feeling sinks in. Come back,
be here.
Yeah, this song. Like, I'm so obsessed with this song nowadays. So, yeah, this song.
Emily. Oh, she's a queen. But I also heard that she's, like, the top percent of, like, using private jets to fly and, like, is a problem that way. But I'm excited for her to come on tour. She announced her Eras tour, and hopefully she comes to Canada.
Would you want to go?
Yeah.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. In today's world, it's usually easy to buy whatever you need when you need it. But as climate change causes more extreme weather, there may be times when it's not safe to leave your home, or times when you need to leave fast. So it's important to have a disaster supply kit ready. At ready.gov, the federal government provides a list of basic items that everyone should have in a disaster supply kit. Some are like packing for a camping trip: water, medicine, first aid kit, change of clothes, flashlight, extra batteries, and food for several days. Other items are more disaster specific: dust masks to filter polluted air, a wrench to turn off utilities, a fire extinguisher, paper maps in case the internet is down, a battery-powered radio, and copies of important documents in a waterproof container. It's not enough to have these items lying around the house. It's best to assemble them in an easy-to-grab bag or box, and review what's inside every few months so you can replace any expired items. You may also want to consider preparing multiple disaster kits so you can keep one at home, one in your car, and one at work. So no matter where you are when an emergency hits, you have the essentials you need to stay safe. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Have you used AI like ChatGPT or others for your assignments?
Yeah, my name is Fahad. I'm just a student majoring in biometrics. I've been using ChatGPT just to get information, like knowledge, and even for assignments as well. But I would, you know, not prefer to, you know, copy paste whatever. See, just learn mostly. I would do, yeah. But I'm using them for sure.
What is your take on AI?
I do see it dominating in the future as well. It's just gonna keep on growing, I believe so, because when it burst out, it was just, you know, like very popular, and over time, it may just. It will grow up to the point that it will replace a lot of jobs that people are doing.
My name is Rina, and I think that AI is useful, but we just need to be careful because it has a lot of effects on our environment because it emits a lot of carbon fuels, and we also have to make sure that we stay honest because a lot of people use it in assignments.
Hi, my name's Natalie. I'm a first year at SFU. I actually have never used AI before. I'm not really familiar with how it works, but I feel like it can be very useful, especially like in terms of studying. It can give you like really good notes and things like that, but for me personally, I'd rather just like come up with my own ideas, and I feel like that way you learn better anyway, so.
What is your take on AI?
My name's Lucci. I'm kind of neutral. It's like, I understand for some people, if they want to figure out like a simple definition or taking notes, it's like easier to like summarize what they read or something. But if it's like for assignments that they have to make and they use ChatGPT, I think obviously it's bad because it's not their own work. But I don't really care because not me.
I'm Emmanuel. I mean, I just hear a lot of people like using it for their assignments. I'd say it's a useful tool, but maybe some people like use it in a bad way. Maybe like, oh, do my work for me. But personally, I haven't used it that much. I only used it for like to explain, because I'm in science. I used it to explain science concepts in maybe a simpler way. So, but yeah, I hear a lot of people like using AI to maybe do their work for them, and I don't know how to feel about that.
I'm Aryan Kaul. I agree. I think it's a useful tool, but at the same time, say, you know, you're trying to further in your degree, do well in your classes, yeah, it might get you the better grade, but also, like, our generation, we're kind of like the future, and if our future's in the hands of, like, us, and we're kind of using AI to kind of do well and further our knowledge, it's probably not the best thing.
Are we really doing the work?
Yeah, are we really doing the work? Because once we're doing the work, you know, we can actually trust ourselves in whatever field we go into.
Hi, my name's Ava. I think AI can be helpful. I wouldn't rely on it entirely for an assignment for school. Often I use it to get an outline or highlight some important topics. I don't use it entirely to do an assignment, but it can definitely be helpful and give you some unique perspectives.
The Patricia Hotel has occupied the corner of Dunleavy and Hastings of the Vancouver East Side for over 100 years. Its lifespan approaches that of Vancouver itself. The surrounding Strathcona neighborhood grew alongside the hotel and has supplied some of the city's richest history. A wealth of culture moved along those streets and through the corridors of the hotel. People's lives pulsed through the building's arteries and spilled out into the world. The building has weathered the Vancouver rains and the neighborhood's mounting social struggles. It continues to provide affordable lodging to travelers in one of the world's least affordable cities, and supports local performers who would otherwise go unnoticed. The story of the hotel begins where the story of old Vancouver ends, because new Vancouver could only rise after old Vancouver burned. James Johnston is an East Vancouver House researcher and historian.
On June 13, 1886, there was a big wind that came up, and a stump fire spread to some other debris, and the wind was going in the right direction, or the wrong direction, I guess, for the city of Vancouver. And in 40 minutes, the new city of Vancouver basically exploded. They said that Vancouver didn't actually burn down. It actually exploded and was consumed in 40 minutes.
Lonnie Resworm is an East Vancouver resident and local historian.
When the fire came, it pretty much cleared out all these rickety, you know, shacks that were thrown up. And so when they rebuilt, which the rebuilding started right away, and it was sort of gave them a clean slate to build what the developers assumed would be like this major West Coast metropolis.
Construction on what would become the Patricia Hotel began in 1910. Originally intended as a doctor's office, the founder of the building, Dr. Thomas Wilson, would not survive to see its completion. The property was acquired by Edward Mulhern, who converted the space into a hotel and opened for business in the summer of 1913. The city had become the modern metropolis predicted by the developers. The railway was bringing in new residents, and the historic Hastings Mill, located a few minutes' walk from the Patricia Hotel, was supplying work to loggers from all over the world.
There's an ad from a 1913 News Herald that talks about it being a new popular priced hotel, and that they advertised it as being two blocks from City Hall. Perhaps that was a draw. It was trying to say that it was really in the center of the happening part of Vancouver.
The typical tenant would be a logger who works out in logging camps most of the year, and then he makes a bunch of money and he comes to Vancouver to spend the winter and blow this wad of cash in his pocket on booze and women and whatever else he's into. Yeah.
They were out to sow their wild oats, to have fun, to maybe have a little bit of a dust up with whoever, but it was to get rid of all the stress, the accumulated stress of living in very, very primitive, cold conditions out in the wild. And so it would have been a rather interesting mix of customers in the Patricia Hotel at that time.
By 1917, Hastings Street had become a swinging entertainment district. The Patricia Hotel opened a cabaret under the title Patricia Cafe, later renamed Pat's Pub. Ada Bricktop Smith, the nightclub queen of Europe, was singing, dancing, and dodging loggers at the hotel before her move to Paris. In her memoirs, Bricktop by Bricktop, she recounts a particularly rowdy New Year's Eve at the cafe.
No one knows what the fight was all about. Everybody was beating up on everybody else. Bowman was a large place. I remember all the fists flying and glass breaking, but that's all I remember. It was one of those special occasions when I lost count of how many drinks I've had. Next thing I knew, I was in the bed in a white room. My right leg was in a splint and my head felt as if it was about to come off. I was in a hospital and my leg was broken. A gal I knew called Dago was standing by the side of the bed. I couldn't believe it when she told me that I kept trying to get into the brawl the night before. You kept running in the middle of all those punches and someone kept pushing you back out, but that didn't stop you. You got right back in the middle of it again and you got pushed out again, but this time you fell down a flight of stairs. She told me I'd been given quite a time to the doctor who tried to set my leg. He'd just come from a party and was feeling no pain himself. We must have been quite the pair. I rolled and turned so violently that I broke three splints. He hadn't been too drunk to do his job, though. My leg healed in a normal length of time and never gave me a bit of trouble. I never told my mama what really happened, just in case she happened to hear something through the grapevine. I wrote and said that I'd sprained my ankle.
Up, raising a lion's den, and my nightly occupation is stealing other women's men.
Ada Bricktop Smith, she was a singer and dancer with the Patricia Orchestra, and another one is Jelly Roll Morton. He's probably the most famous guy who played there.
Jelly Roll Morton played the piano for me.
used to bill himself as the originator of jazz. Both of their descriptions of the Patricia in Vancouver at the time was that, yeah, the audiences didn't really get it.
James Dandifer is a Vancouver-based composer and jazz clarinetist.
What? I'm from here. I've been playing Jelly Roll Morton's music, and I didn't know that he lived in Vancouver and that he worked at Pat's Pub, which is, you know, obviously still standing.
There was this idea, I guess, like a slippery slope kind of tendency in terms of morality, where you starts out with going into a place for, you know, drinking a little beverage, and then music comes on, and then especially with like this crazy jazz music, it's like becomes a little bit sexual maybe.
Jazz originally was jazz, J-A-S-S, which was slang for sex. That kind of keys you into what this music meant at the time. It was really passionate, exciting, and sexy.
It was the leading edge of music at the time, and people responded to it in the same way that people responded to rock and punk now. And it had its fans, and it had its people who didn't like it.
Ain't nobody dead. Somebody must be dead drunk. Don't tell me. I think it's a funeral. Say, look here. People, I do hear a funeral. People hear that trombone fall.
Greatest crash in the history of the New York Stock Exchange and market prices.
Provide health care for every man, woman, and child.
How far would you go with that? How far would you extend that?
Just watch it.
No, I've got cancer in my lungs.
Meat pepper, I put it on my plate.
Something set on fire in downtown Vancouver. Some windows broken in office buildings. Riot police have been deployed trying to control...
A century later, Vancouver has hardened. The roads are all paved now, and the structures lining them are formed from rebar and concrete. The neighborhood around the hotel has descended into unyielding poverty, while the bourgeoisie sit poised in trendy shops around its perimeter. The Patricia Hotel continues to serve underfunded travelers, and in the evenings showcases local performers in the same room where Jelly Roll and Ada shook the walls. For the past decade, East Vancouver has hosted an inspired musical moment, which prowled through the venues on Hastings Street. Cheering sonics and daring performances are on offer as young musicians express themselves and grasped for things out of reach. Their vibrations often left to mingle with those of Ada and Jelly Roll in the brick walls of Pat's Pub. Ryan Dick is a local record label owner and musician.
I don't know if Pat's is really in an entertainment district anymore. I mean, closer to Gastown, I've definitely noticed there's a lot more clubs and a lot more, like, normal people coming in from the suburbs to go, you know, do whatever normal people do on a Friday night, which is kind of nice because you don't have to deal with suburbanites for the most part.
Adrian Burris is a musician based in Vancouver.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely one of the venues that was plugged into what was happening in the music scene. Like, it was a safe place, it was fun, it was, you know, easy to get a show there, there was always shows happening.
Vancouver at that point was well known for, like, cutesy indie pop stuff, and then all these bands started that were making pretty noisy punk music, so it was pretty exciting, it was really fun.
I definitely wanted in, and I definitely wanted to be part of what I thought was really progressive and interesting music.
Music Waste is a local music festival, and we try to focus on new artists every year. Yeah, Pat's has always been really supportive of Music Waste. They always are happy to give us the days, and there's been some pretty fun shows there.
I've never really felt unsafe in the Hastings area. You know, I've been attacked in Surrey, but not on Hastings. People look out for each other down here, and they care about each other, and yeah.
Richard Peterson and Deborah Adams stayed in the Patricia Hotel in the summer of 2014.
We arrived in Vancouver a warm July afternoon. I had booked a room at the Patricia Hotel. The area where the hotel stands is one of the most infamous in Vancouver. Everyone knows that East Hastings is a place you will die instantly. A hotel on Hastings is one where the doors won't lock, the faucets will drip, and the door to the bathroom will be lightweight with a minimum 2-inch gap at the bottom. An adventure. Deborah wasn't so sure. Our tropical vacation a few months earlier had been loaded. Love and the idea of forever was on my mind. The place was going to be perfect, and it wasn't. Something didn't feel right. It was the turning point. The Patricia has a great location. Eat some baozi from Chinatown, or the most trendy burger at that upstairs place down Main. The hotel is old. It's great. Instantly transported to my grandmother's house. The counter guy was efficient and so very concerned with who came first. We came first. He reached across the counter and hit the elevator button for us. How pleasant. Some real old-timey service. All food and beer with friends that evening. Things were chatty and enjoyable. Deborah mentioned the thing. It was our big argument before we left China. I was a little drunk and said something that could have been sexy, but ended up not so. I could see she wanted to tell the story. I was slightly opposed. When I returned from the bathroom, the secret had been kept, and for the rest of my trip, I was swamped by questions unanswered. Deborah was tired, but I had decided long ago that I would go to a concert that evening. I was racked with guilt and trying to make up for the approved activity for that evening. Offering to go back with her and then come back, though, it was clear I didn't want to. I believe the words were, "You're acting like a douche." I was. She was fine. I returned to the hotel at 2 a.m. and joined a sleeping Deborah in the soft bed. A couple days later, my friends were invited to our room in the early morning in order to stage a walking adventure through town. We were four now, and the room tightened accordingly. Below, a woman yelled profanity into the void. A bus pushed into a lane. My friends commented on the strange bathroom layout. Deborah remarked how she could take a dump and put her feet up on the bed at the same time. On our way to the lobby, my buddy and I bolted down the stairs. Century-old floorboards thundered. Deborah and Larry took the elevator. After a day of fun in the sun, Deborah was a little tired of hanging with people she didn't really know and wanted alone time. A decision to flee was made as the sun slipped away. No guilt tonight. A cab ride got us back to the open arms of Pat's Pub and the last hours of Jazz Fest. Gentle music flowed out of the fire exit where we smoked frequently, a behavior seemingly out of fashion around most of Vancouver. The neighborhood around the Patricia Hotel isn't particularly fashionable, however. Our smokes were in high demand. Deborah was flying out the next day, but I was staying behind, leaving the Patricia for my friend's couch. Deborah and I said a goodbye that lingered, one of our last. My buddy picked us up at the hotel and drove us to Waterfront Station for a last-minute stroll before the airport. On the way to my friend's place, we drove past the Patricia. It may just be where all roads in Vancouver lead. The kidney of the city. It was sunny.
Most recently, the Patricia Hotel has reclaimed its musical roots and established itself as one of Vancouver's premium jazz venues. Several days a week, local performers take charge of the stage and aspire to have their tones connect with listeners.
As a jazz musician in Vancouver, knowing that one of the geniuses of jazz music played there, that really affects the feel of the place. The first time I walked through those doors, I just felt this connection to the past. I felt this sort of, I was just sort of awestruck. Like, This is where it happened, you know. And so I know as a performer, I feel there's a certain energy there that that comes from knowing what the past was.
James Dandifer continues to perform in Vancouver and can be reached at jamesdandifer.com. Adrian Burris performs as Adrian Teacher with his latest group, The Subs. Ryan Dick continues to support essential local talent with his record label, Hockey Dad Records. Lonnie Russworm's book, Vancouver Was Awesome can be found at your local bookstore and library, and James Johnstone hosts walking tours of historic Vancouver neighborhoods and can be reached at historywalksinvancouver.blogspot.ca. Produced with the support and assistance of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, and the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
For 40 years, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, a.k.a. SFPIRG, has been helping students build communities at SFU. Campus organizations like Out on Campus and Embark developed out-of action groups at SFPIRG. Action groups are one of the ways that student activists can take action for change. Visit us at www.sfpirg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.